Thank you for the introduction, Jeff. I guess at a time like this, it's appropriate to say I'm glad to be here. It's actually the first thing I've done since I retired. Can you believe that? We found that it was good to take some time out. And I've enjoyed about 10 months spending time with my wife. Now that's a change, very pleasant change. But it is good to be standing at the desk once again. I did take a couple of classes, I must say, for John Chapazic last week. But it has been good to be able to step back for just a little while. We're actually we're about to be homeless. We're moving out of our home this week and we're going to be building a new home, but that probably won't be ready for another 12 months. So we'll be in our caravan, basically, for the next 12 months, which will be an interesting experience in togetherness. I must just mention before I start, if that's okay, Jeff, one of the projects I have accepted an invitation to work on is the upcoming Encyclopedia of Seventh-day Adventists. We have published a one-volume encyclopedia. I think the first was part of the commentary reference series about 1965. It was updated in the 90s. But this time, I think it's fair to say the encyclopedia will be much more comprehensive in scope. It will have associate editors from every division, and I've accepted the responsibility of being the associate editor for our division. And at this point of time, we've put together about 700 distinct articles which need to be written for the South Pacific. That will be no mean task. So perchance I come knocking on your door or tapping you on the shoulder ere long. It will be to assist in doing some research and perhaps some writing, because I know many of you here this afternoon are just the sort of people who would love to get into something like that. We will be doing original research, and it will be articles above 1,500 words will be refereed. So it's going to be something very attractive to academic institutions, including Avondale, around the world. So that is something that will keep me out of mischief just a little over the next probably 3 or 4 years. It's planned to launch it online, and maybe the first edition will be printed, but primarily it will be an online resource. In talking with Jeff, he asked me, as he has said, to reflect this afternoon, and that's what I would like to do. But he gave me a little guidance as to the sort of things I should look at. Positive developments. I'll spend just a little bit of time looking at some positive developments. I'm going to look at some inhibiting factors also. You didn't mention that one, Jeff, but I will mention that. Situations where I might consider doing things differently over the years at the division. Decision making. That will take a little bit of time. Decision making processes in the church is becoming too centralised, etc. You can see the sort of things we may talk about there. And finally, Jeff asked me to talk about the implications of the fact that there are more administrators than church pastors employed by the church. I'll talk about that. I will confine myself largely to these areas, but inevitably I will wander a little further afield. Many things, as you are well aware, are easy to ask, not so easy to answer. And there's usually much more involved than what appears on the surface. That's certainly the true with most of the things I will talk about this afternoon. Secondly, I will be primarily talking about the church as it is beyond the local church. I'm not particularly going to address local church issues today, primarily issues that impact on the global church and perhaps the division beyond the local church, although I am very well aware that the local church is the place where mission actually happens. An old expression I used to use when at Avondale, it's where the rubber meets the road. It's where everything that happens elsewhere in the church is actually applied. And if what happens elsewhere doesn't work at the local church, well, it's not worth having. It's fairly pointless. The function of the church generally is to empower, enhance the effectiveness of the local church. The third thing, these are simply my reflections. They don't bear any official stamp. They may or may not be your reflections, and I'm very comfortable with that. And fourth, I will illustrate from time to time with a PowerPoint slide. Most of them are my own. I do acknowledge my former colleague, Rodney Brady. Rod has shared a few of these PowerPoints with me from his time in various committees and a couple of committees he sits on at the General Conference. So to the questions. The first one being, what do you see as positive developments in meeting the mission of the church? I'm speaking globally. And the first thing I'd like to refer to is the tremendous impact of Adventist World Radio. We don't know a lot about Adventist World Radio in this division because it doesn't really impact us too much. It was primarily set up to impact the 1040 window, those areas of the world that have almost no Christians and very few Adventists. But Adventist World Radio is one of the tremendous successes of the church. A couple of statistics there I think I put up. There are 17 million podcasts downloaded every day. It's the largest provider of foreign language programs on iTunes. And you can actually go and listen to it, even if you can't get it through the airwaves. There's a website where you can go and listen to Adventist World Radio. Particularly in the 1040 window, as I said, you can see some of the places where the various, what do you call them? Stations are reaching out to, different footprints. And again, you notice there it's primarily through that centre section. Arabic and Mandarin are the languages that, let me just get this right, the most downloaded language, here it is, in those podcasts is Mandarin. The next most downloaded language is Arabic. Tremendous success. Adventist World Radio. I can't give you a statistic on how many people are joining the church. All I can give you are statistics as far as the reach and the impact that we know it is having in terms of downloads, podcasts, etc. Much of its work is being done in Islamic countries, communist countries, where you can't very well produce statistics. The second thing that I think has been a success over the years, my time at the division, has been Hope Channel. Hope Channel now is broadcasting over 1,000 hours a day and is actually the largest Christian denominationally owned and operated TV network in the world. We have, let me just get it right here, 68 channels compared with something like Trinity have 28 channels globally. And you notice there in South America, 29,000 people identified Hope Channel as the primary source for them joining the church. So globally, this is making a very, very large impact. It's a success story for our church as it's developed over the last, well, really only 20 years or so. Another thing that I think is very significant is the formation of a Middle East and North Africa Union. As a result of global mission thinking from the beginning of the 90s, where instead of simply focusing on those areas of the world where we were doing well, we said, hang on, we've got to go to those areas where we're not doing well and start to really concentrate in areas where there are very few Adventists and very few Christians. So you'll notice right up there, there's a light blue section. That's the Middle East and North Africa Union. You'll see it's actually larger than many of the divisions in the world. It covers an area of, a considerable area, probably 350 million plus live in that area. And let me give you the statistic. In that
area, at the end of 2014, there were 3,423 church members. Did you get that? That's approximately one per 100,000. If we had that proportion in Australia, we would have one congregation of 250 members. That would be it. There is a huge need. I'm glad we have intentionally, from the General Conference, it's taken it under its wing, decided to use resources to reach an area where, frankly, we've had very little success. The next area I think has been a major success for us is the focus on discipleship. You see here the mission statement of the General Conference. When I started going to the General Conference a few years ago, the mission statement was three pages long. And it described just about everything we did. About 4 or 5 years ago now, we said, hang on, what is the central focus of what we're about? And although I had wished this would even have been shorter, you nevertheless notice that the mission of the Seventh-day Adventist Church is to call all people to become disciples of Jesus Christ. I would have liked it to stop there, because I think that says it all. But it was outvoted in this occasion, and that's fine. At least we have one sentence now as the global mission statement. But this focus on discipleship, you will hear it over and over again. You'll read it in the record. You'll hear it from our leaders in the conferences and unions and division here. And you'll hear it right around the world. I think it's the right way to go. A disciple is a complete, holistic person. It's just not focusing on outreach. It's also focusing on nurture. It's focusing on all it takes to be a disciple. And I think that's what the Adventist Church is about. I'm glad to see that has now been articulated appropriately in the mission statement and increasingly in the strategic thinking of the church. I think that is a big one. Another area where I think we have done well globally is by focusing on the various world religions by establishing major study centres, as you see them listed there, to look at how we can effectively implement and fulfil our mission in the various contexts of the world as we know it. And so those have been established, have been operating, and every year when we'd go over for meetings at the General Conference, we would receive reports in what was called a Mission Issues Committee. Of all the committees I sat on at the General Conference, the one I enjoyed most was the Mission Issues Committee, because we got into nitty-gritty stuff about how to make our mission more effective, more contextual, in the various areas of the world where, while we're having some success, we want to have much more success. That Mission Issues Committee was mainly organised by our own Gary Krause, by the way. One of the reasons I think why it works so well. I didn't say that. Okay, another great thing that's been happening is the financial uptake outside North America. Wait on, have I gone too far? I haven't got this one down. Isn't that amazing? Financial uptake outside of North America. 3 years ago, the tithe percentage shifted so that no longer was America giving the majority of the global tithe in the world church. Now the other areas of the world have caught up and have overtaken North America, expressed in US dollars, in terms of global tithe. And I think that says a number of things. For one, it shows the tremendous generosity of North America over the years. North America has been fantastic, carrying this church on its shoulders in terms of the financial burden over the years. And they have been tremendously generous. But it's good to see that other areas of the world are also, particularly those areas that were former mission-receiving countries, are accepting their responsibility and are in an increasing position to be able to support the global work of the church. Our division has done well, particularly Australia. Australia for many years has been right at the top of the global statistics in terms of tithe per member. And Rob McIver, you hear Rob? Rob's not here, but Rob McIver has done some tremendous research for the General Conference over a couple of years now, and it's worth reading, showing tithe patterns throughout the global church. But to see that responsibility increasingly is a good thing. Within our own division now, let's go forward. In our own division, some of the things that I have been excited about, which might seem a little mundane, but at the division office, we integrated the delivery of media and communication services. The Adventist Media Network now includes print, it includes electronic, it includes visual, it includes communication, it includes the Bible Discovery Centre. Those things were a little disjointed previously. Now they come under one umbrella, which is helping very much in the delivery of our media and communication services. We brought all of our people services together under one umbrella at the division to bring greater efficiency into the delivery of the things that impact on our people. Things like human resources, our services to our missionaries who go out to various places, sustentation, etc., etc. The establishment of Adventist support, later named Safe Place Services, and now to be named the Office for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable People. You are all very well aware of the blight that we have in society and the fact that our church, unfortunately, has not been immune from the abuse of various kinds that has been perpetuated. I remember when I first went to the division 18 years ago now, we did not have such an office, and the number of issues which were coming across my desk, and we said to ourselves, we cannot simply just ignore, well, we certainly could not ignore, and so I'm very thankful that we established what was Adventist Support and is now to be the Office for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable People, so that we can make sure that as a church we are meeting our responsibility where abuses occurred, where we're caring for people who have been so abused, and we're doing everything we can to prevent it going into the future. That was a very important thing for us and continues to be, as all of these do. The fact that we've had an Ireland National as Secretary of the South Pacific Division is fantastic. Fantastic to see people from our Ireland nations accepting responsibility in the broader scheme of things. Strategic thinking has come a long way and continues now to develop in what we do right across our various entities and institutions in the South Pacific. And so I could keep it going. I could talk about the strength of our division institutions. Sanitarium has never been stronger. And our universities, Avondale, Sydney Adventist Hospital, etc. They're good things that have been happening. And so there are many positive things. And I'm just really skimming across the surface. But let me come to inhibiting factors. What do I see as some of the things that are inhibiting the meeting of the mission of the church? You didn't ask me this one, Jeff, but I want to put it in. The first thing, a widespread inability to recognise the need for unity in diversity. The church is indeed a global village. We're all aware of that, and I'm talking globally here. I remember working with George Knight back in 1986 when I was doing my research, and George said, he said, you know, Barry, I doubt if the church will survive till the 21st century as we now know it. His reason was, and he said, I don't think North America will be able to accept the diversity of the former mission territories. I thought that was interesting coming from George. Well, fortunately, George is not a prophet or the son of one, and the church has survived into the 21st century, but it is struggling hugely with this issue. What he said has partly come true. But interestingly, the traditional mission sending areas are finding it difficult to accept the success of their own missionary endeavours. Traditional mission receiving areas are flexing their muscle. The balance of power has shifted in the church. Time will tell how the church will respond. Unity in diversity, I believe, is the only way forward for us to be able to cope and be a global community. Failure to understand this principle was illustrated by the unfortunate situation with ordination. The question put to the floor of the General Conference session was intentionally framed to allow for as much diversity as possible given the polarised viewpoints on the issue. And I guess there is some good news in that with each vote the situation has become a little better, so that now 42% of the delegates were prepared to vote in the affirmative of the question. The unfortunate situation is the majority was still not allowed. Based on their reading or interpretation of scripture as seen through their specific cultural, historical and personal contexts, it seems that as a global church, the majority are still not able to recognise and accept the need for unity in diversity. And it's still one of our greatest challenges as we go forward. I believe we can only exist as a healthy church if we do indeed recognise the need for unity in diversity. Secondly, there is still too limited success in applying Adventist lifestyle, theology, and mission to the diverse contexts that we find ourselves in the 21st century. Now, this is obviously related to my first point. We need to continually find ways to recognise and implement a contextual approach to mission. This simply means we are willing to work within, appropriately, the specific situation in which we find ourselves in order to communicate the message that we have to share. It's about rendering a specific message hearable, acceptable. There are two aspects. First of all, the message itself must remain authentic. It must maintain its integrity as the message to be communicated. Failure to do that will result in syncretism, the loss of the message itself. But secondly, the vehicle for transcribing or transmitting the message must be viable. Those who are to receive the message must be able to hear and understand it within their context. In well-worn communication terminology, it's the discussion about the message and the medium. Failure to recognise and implement this principle when it comes to theology, lifestyle, evangelism, missionary endeavour, organisational structures, whatever you will, just about anything you care to name can hurt us badly. And it is. There is a need for critical contextualisation. And there's a corporate aspect to that as well as a personal individual aspect as an individual, interface with my world. We have done some good things in that area. Still a long way to go. Thirdly, loss of reason for existence. Julie and I were visiting with one of our family members not so long ago, lifelong Seventh-day Adventist. And this person said, looking at me, just why do we actually baptise people into the Seventh-day Adventist Church? And we talked about it. This is a question of identity. Who are we? Who am I? The longer I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, it seems this question becomes, for many, more difficult to answer. What is it that differentiates us? Why is it that we do exist? And we could spend the rest of the afternoon right here. It's particularly challenging because as a church we've often been accused of being strange, peculiar, unusual. And I guess we want to demonstrate that we're not so strange. We're a bit like everyone else. The problem is, in endeavouring to do that, we can, in fact, lose what differentiates us and makes us special. At this point, I just want to pay a special tribute to our colleague, Graham Bradford. We lost Graham this week. But Graham was one who I particularly admired for endeavouring to find that which makes us special. And I remember working together with him when he was producing his series on the Book of Revelation. And later, of course, he and John Paulian recorded that. And Graham would come to me excited. Look, this is so special. This is why we exist as a church. And I think he did a great job in taking the latest in research and scholarship and ensuring that it was particularly an Adventist approach to the Book of Revelation. If we lose our reason for existence, we lose everything. We can all just quietly disappear into the sunset. Organisational life cycle. There's a certain inevitability about the effect of a passage of time on an organisation. We are, in this respect, like any other organisation. We are human, after all. Sociologists and students of organisational culture talk about the organisational life cycle as being birth, infancy, adolescence, prime, maturity, aristocracy, bureaucracy, and then death. They sort of grow it in a, show it in a sort of a bell curve. Just before death is bureaucracy. It's characterised by low energy, low effectiveness of mission, but a large base. Unless you intervene at every cycle, every stage of the life cycle or the organisational cycle to rejuvenate the organisation, and particularly at the aristocracy and bureaucracy end, it will inevitably run its course and you'll die. I remember when I first came across this in the mid-80s, I got the fright of my life because I read it and thought, us, everywhere in the aristocracy and bureaucracy section. We have to be fairly intentional as we move forward, becoming an older organisation. We cannot afford to simply follow the same pattern as is outlined in this theory. To us, mission, identity, empowerment, all these things are vital if we are to move forward. And that brings me to the next area of questioning, and that is the area of decision making. And Jeff, you asked the question, as you put it to me, is decision making becoming too centralised? Here's the easy answer. Yes and no. Here's the more complex answer. It depends on who asks the question, and it certainly depends on who answers it. It depends on the level of understanding of how decision making works. It depends on an understanding of the complex nature of the church on a global scale. It's simply not an easy question to answer, and it's not straightforward. I think in order to answer this question effectively, I'd like to just spend a little bit of time on talking about how decision making in the church does operate, or how it's supposed to operate. It's a little bit risky because some of you are very familiar with this, others not so familiar, but it very much impacts on the question. The church operates and makes decisions on the basis of what could be called an appointment cycle. At the local church, delegates are sent to the conference or mission session, and there the administration of the conference and the executive committee are appointed. People who are so sent are involved in decision making. The Mission Executive Committee, or the Conference Executive Committee, appoints delegates to the Union Session, where administration and Executive Committee members are appointed. The Union Executive Committee appoints delegates to the General Conference Session, and the General Conference Session appoints administration, staff, Executive Committee, Division Office, Division Executive Committee, and Division Executive Committee appoints Union Mission Officers and departmental staff. I guess that is the primary decision-making cycle, if you like, that operates in the church as far as how we make decisions. When it comes to church structure, There are a number of structural pieces. The General Conference, with its 13 divisions. There are 132 unions, union conferences and missions around the world. 646 conferences and missions, 148,000 local churches and companies. And I showed you previously how the system works through those various entities. The other major structural pieces attached to those various entities, there are institutions and schools plugged in at different points in the structure. There are services and agencies. There are departments which, by their nature, are not administrative. That means that in the World Church there are 157,000 organisations. That's a lot, isn't it? I'm including their local churches and companies, but conferences, unions, divisions, etc. As well as that, in terms of how the church functions, we have to recognise that each of those levels are constituent. In a sense, each is independent. Because each level of the, well, certainly the local conference, union conference, general conference, have constitutions. And they are based on the people within those entities making the decisions which guide those entities. Those decisions are generally made at a session. And of course, between sessions, by the executive committee. Something happened here. In terms of the function of each of those, looks like we're right back at the beginning again, eh? Technology, isn't that wonderful? What's happening? Okay, in terms of those entities that I just said are constituent bodies, they have to operate in two environments. One is a corporate environment, where they're bound by corporate law, and there's the constitution, the bylaws. A board, which operates within the corporate environment, has what you call fiduciary responsibility to the members. That is, it must act in the best interest of the members. It cannot act in its own best interests. This is a very strong corporate legal dictum in Australia. Secondly, we work within an ecclesiastical framework, held together by working policy and church manual, unincorporated association. Perhaps a different set of laws depending on the jurisdiction dealing with unincorporated associations. The church must operate within both. And that brings a fair degree of complexity now into the decision-making process of a local conference, a union, or a division. As well as that, we need to remember that we are a representative democracy. In a direct democracy, every member can vote on each decision, particularly in the choice of leaders. But in a representative democracy, the selection of representatives who then vote on the decision-making process, on the selection of leaders, well, not so much as the selection of leaders, because that is done by everyone at the session, but again, they are representatives. Then various committees operate for the church, a shared administration model. We don't have a presidential system. We are governed by policy and constitutions. Authority and our accountability is exercised through the committee system. Think about authority. Authority is distributed through the organisation. There are different types of authority at different places in the organisation. The distribution of authority helps to unite the church. No one part is complete in itself. Authority always ascends to a group. It resides in the church membership, but then, through the processes of decision-making, it ascends to a group of people, not to an individual. Final authority is never in our church in one individual. It's always in a group. Every elected appointed leader is accountable to a group. And no group or committee has greater authority than the group that appointed it. That system may not be perfect, but generally it works pretty well. It ensures that, for example, as division president, it was never my prerogative to make a decision which affected the church at large. It was always my responsibility to be answerable to the group, primarily the division executive committee, but also the general conference executive committee, also the unions and conferences, the constituency of the church. And that is the way the church operates. Coming to decision making. we haven't always done well in terms of applying authority as well as we could have. There's a classic example back in the 1880s and 1890s that we have referred to often. The growing global missionary consciousness of the church during the 1870s and 1880s was accompanied by increased centralisation of administrative control. Centralisation of authority was most evident in the tendency to deprive the constituent bodies of the organisation of their decision-making authority. In a letter to W.C. and Mary White in 1883, Ellen White pointed out that every one of our leading men considered that he was the very one who must bear all the responsibilities and failed to educate others to think and to act. Implicit in her condemnation of those who follow that practice was reproof for those who permitted them to do it without seeking to correct the situation. Conference leaders, for instance, were told that they were to make their own decisions. The president of the General Conference could not possibly understand the situation as well as you are on the ground. These words were spoken to the delegates assembled at the General Conference session in 1883. As a corrective to the tendency to leave the prerogative for decision-making in the hands of one or two, Ellen White advocated proper use of the committee system that had been established when the General Conference had been organised in 1863. She made it clear that even in the operation of institutions, one man's mind was not to control the decision-making process. She emphasised that God would not have many minds in the shadow of one man's mind, but that in a multitude of counsel there is safety. That's pretty strong stuff, isn't it? And we have to be ever vigilant as a church to ensure that that sort of thing does not happen in the church. What is the place of decision making? The most effective way is through the processes I've just very briefly outlined at all levels of the church. The local church with its boards and business meeting. The local conference with its session and executive committees. The union, the session and the executive committee. The division, the executive committee, because we don't have a session at the division because we are not a constituent body. We are part of the General Conference. And the General Conference, of course, through its executive committee. Members can contribute to decision-making through participation in these various constituency meetings. That is the best way for any of us to have a voice in the operation of the church, by being participants in a constituency meeting or a session. It takes time, but it is so important to the operation of the church. Membership of boards and committees. I have valued incredibly over the years the input of wise, experienced lay people, church employees, who have contributed to various boards and committees. And there is a lot of need, a lot of scope for boards and committees. The boards of our major institutions are dependent on the work and the experience of very fine lay people, and I could give you a very considerable list. Within entities, there can be recommendations from one entity to another as part of the decision-making process, from a church board to a conference, from a union to a division, etc., as people within those entities make decisions. By personal or group representation to boards and committees. I remember at the division many times we would have groups of people who would come and express various issues and concerns. I remember a group, some of you in this room were part of that group, who came and expressed a concern about some changes that were intended to the fundamental beliefs. And those sort of things are taken very seriously by wise administrations and are passed through various committees and boards. In that particular case, it went right to the General Conference, I remember. There's opportunity for consultation and discussion with those who are appointed to act in a representative capacity. We can find out who they are. They may be lay people or employed people. Don't hold back from talking to people who are in various positions of representation. Keep in mind always, however, that the church does operate by majority vote, or by two-thirds majority in constitutional and strategic matters. And sometimes I simply have to accept the fact that my particular viewpoint is not the majority viewpoint. And I've had that experience a number of times. A member's disengaging from the decision-making process. I'll come to that one in just a minute. I can only respond to this question anecdotally. I've heard that there are certainly some who have become disenchanted. And I guess there are certainly times when decisions are made which we do not as individuals believe to be in the best interests of the church. Looking from the perspective of one who has been very much involved in decision making at all levels of the church, I would observe that in fact there are very few decisions that are best or right for everybody. Most decisions are made in less than perfect circumstances. Most decisions. And there is always, or almost always, going to be somebody or some group who does not find the decision ideal. I guess the way I approach that is that all of us need to do the best we can when we're involved in decision making. And speaking for myself, and that's all I can do, when a decision is made by a majority vote that is not the decision I would have wished, I try my best to understand the perspective of those who have made the decision and live with it where I possibly can. What are the implications now, coming on to the next point, of having more administrators than pastors? Jeff, you showed me this quote from a recent Spectrum article, and it's pulled out of a larger section. And let me just read it. Quoting George Knight, "If I were the devil, I would undermine the importance of the local congregation." And Lawrence Sebold from Spectrum has a denomination, "We have not made local church a priority." Brian, it's talking about Alex, is it Alex Bryant? Alec Bryant? Explained the problem. "Adventist theology focuses on the life to come rather than the here and now. While careful to point out that there is a goal, that the goal was not to criticise administrators, but rather the system we have all created, he shared a graph revealing the most recent ratio of pastors, 4,498 to administrators, 5,783. I won't get into the reasoning, but I want you to know it's the last statistic. It looks as though the administrators outnumber pastors. So we went and did some checking, Jeff. Discovered for a start these are North American figures. They're not global figures. They represent the statistics at the end of 2013. But I did discover this. While the 4,498 is in fact an accurate reflection of pastors who are in field work, that is caring for local churches, ordained, licensed, commissioned, 5,783 is in fact the number of people who are categorised as administrative, promotional, office and miscellaneous employees. Now I have the actual printout here. So in actual fact, I think the article is trying to imply that there are more ministers in administration than are in field work. But in fact, that's not the case, because of that 5,783, let me just get this right, 422 only are ordained pastors. Most of the rest of those would be people like secretaries, office cleaners, etc., etc. All right? So it's probably not true to imply here that somehow we have more ministers involved in administration than we do in field work. That's clearly not the case. However, having said that, we must do everything we possibly can constantly to ensure that we have ministers where they are meant to be, as much as possible, in the field. The best way I know to accomplish that is to ensure that we have fewer organisational entities. Fewer organisational entities. I don't know if you've ever been to a conference session and tried to reduce the number of people in the office as against the number of people in the field. Many times I've experienced trying to reduce, for example, the number of people in departmental leadership as an example, and put more people out into field work. And inevitably that gets voted down, because we can almost make a good reason, I guess, for having a specialist in a role in the office that's going to care for the whole conference or the whole mission or the whole area. That's an argument that's often made. So the only solution I see is to actually reduce the number of administrative units. What do I mean by that? Well, in Australia, for example, we have 10 administrative units for Australia. One union and 9 conferences. 10. You think of the number of people, I didn't do the stats, who are in offices as against the number of people who are serving in partial capacities. We could reduce the number of people in offices quite dramatically by reducing the number of organisational entities. In Australia, you could get away, I believe, with 4 entities. Combine the union, at least do away with the union as such, and have 4 regional, call them union of conferences or union of churches, whatever term you want to make. One in the west, one in the central, one in the south, one in the north. And you could have 4 organisational unities which would immediately reduce the number of people in the office. No question about it. Okay, in each one you might have to have a couple more, but you're not going to have the equivalent of what you have now in 10 organisational units. We did something like that back in 2000, by the way. We endeavoured to reduce the number of unions. That's what we could do from the division. Reduce the number of unions in our division from 5 to 4. And it was a huge task. I couldn't have never anticipated how incredibly challenging it would be to reorganise the church in the South Pacific Division. And let me just give you very quickly an insight into what we had to do. The division formed a committee to look at what could happen. We had dialogue. We put articles in the record. We sought responses. We made adjustments. A website was established. In November 1999, the Division Executive Committee approved the proposal and recommended it to the General Conference. The General Conference had to look at it. In May 2000, the committee approved the proposal and recommended it to the union conferences and division session. You see, the trick is when you've got constituent bodies, they have to vote themselves out of existence in order to form new constituent bodies. And that might sound real easy, but when you're doing a radical restructure, everybody's got to vote themselves out of existence or else the whole thing falls over. So if we tried to do what I just suggested, make 4 regions in Australia, that would be massive. Because every conference and union would have to vote itself out of existence. If one of them didn't, the whole proposal falls down in order to reformulate new constituent bodies. And that is challenging stuff. The General Conference Committee approved the recommendation. A special session of the Trans Australia Union Conference, remember the old Trans Australia in Sydney, took an action to receive the South Pacific Division proposal. In harmony with the action of the Trans-Australian Union Conference Executive Committee, approve that the Trans-Australian Union Conference dissolve, effective January 1, 2001, in favour of the establishment of the Australian Union Conference, comprising the 9 Australian conferences. Then the Trans-Tasman, that must have been the Trans-Commonwealth, that last one. This is the Trans-Tasman. Then in harmony with the recommendation from the South Pacific Division, we approved the dissolution of the Trans-Tasman Union Conference, effective December 31, in favour of the establishment of the Australian Union Conference, a New Zealand Pacific Union Conference, etc. And so the unions actually voted themselves out of existence, which was amazing. And then the proposal itself was to have an Australian Union Conference, a New Zealand Pacific Union Conference, a Papua New Guinea Union Commission, and a Western Pacific Union Mission. And it happened. It happened. I'm still, even this long afterwards, amazed that it actually happened. It reduced the number of unions from 5 to 4. It worked to avoid unnecessary duplication of departments. It provided a national voice in each country for the church. It reduced personnel and financial resources that are directly linked to the administrative structure by 27 persons. And that actually happened. In fact, it was more than that when it actually rolled out. It strengthened the financial base that underwrites the operation of the church. It reduces the number of positions that require expatriate involvement in the Pacific. It establishes a more economical span of control. It redirected $1.7 million back to conferences here in Australia and New Zealand as a result of them not having the same contribution. Allows for the utilisation of modern technology. Reduces staff. We reduced staff at the division, I think at that time, by about 20 people. Encourages missions to achieve conference status. Okay, so it is possible, but I think it's extremely challenging, and it can be done to achieve something like that. My last point, and I'm about to finish because I want you to be able to have some questions. What would I have liked to have seen accomplished that was not accomplished? Well, just what I've been talking about, organisational rationalisation. I would love to have seen us able to reduce the number of organisational units further so we are able to deploy more people into evangelistic and pastoral work. I would love to have seen more of our missions in the Pacific becoming conferences. We only achieved one, Central Papua. French Polynesia is well on the way, as is Fiji and a few others. I would love to have seen Avondale move to university status. That was something that I really hope we'd be able to accomplish, but it was still on the way. I would love to have seen ordination without reference to gender voted in those areas of the world that were ready and able to go ahead. And I would love to have seen more integration of supportive lay organisations with the church and working more closely together. We have achieved it in many cases, but still not as well as I would like to have seen. Time's up. Much more to say, but perhaps we'll leave it there, Jeff, for some questions.